Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Executive Director of Stanford Jazz Workshop, Corey Combs, on the 54th Annual Stanford Jazz Festival. We caught up with this esteemed executive to talk about his roots in Wichita, loving jazz, and the stellar 6 weeks of live music and education taking place from June 21st to July 31st, 2026. There will be Beale's Centennial Celebrations of Miles at 100 featuring Jeremy Pelt and Jimmy Heath at 100 with Jeb Patton and David Wong. Having grown up in both size and reputation since it first began in 1972, the festival, which draws thousands of fans from the Bay Area, has become a destination for all art lovers in one of the most bucolic settings in the nation. This year's festival celebrates jazz's rich roots and its global connections, featuring an exceptional lineup spanning generations and styles, from acclaimed world-class headliners such as Billy Childs, George Cables, Branford Marsalis, and Anat Cohen, to local Northwest natives such as the Westerlies, Nick Rossi, Nicholas Beard, and Sasha Berliner, to innovative jazz fusings with Afro-Cuban, Brazilian, and Indian music. The 25-plus events include festival debuts, world premieres, family-friendly concerts, and so much more. Dig this overview and interview. But you got a lot going on. These shows and everything that's coming up, it looks wonderful, so I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, you bet. So before we get into the shows, I want to begin with, I always start with the COVID question. There was so much that changed because of COVID 6 years ago. How did you get through that era, and how did it change your approach to music and what you're doing today?
Yeah, it was huge for me personally and for the organization that I was working with at the time. I was not at Stanford Jazz, but I was with another organization that is a music nonprofit called Intermusic. And our mission was to, is still, but when I was there, we were supporting the professional lives of Bay Area working musicians. So these were classical jazz, anything in between, really, but folks that identified as professional performers and educators. And so we did that through grant making and fiscal sponsorship, kind of managing their assets and helping them fundraise, but also through grant opportunities for projects. So we had, over the years, given out millions of dollars in project funding. So when that hit, everyone sort of in our network of about 100 different ensembles that we were, that we had some oversight on, looked to me to say, what am I supposed to do now? And of course, I understood why they were asking me, but I also was like, I am also wondering what we're supposed to do right now. Because not only were they concerned about their livelihoods and being able to continue their artistic paths, I was concerned about the ability to keep this organization afloat, because we depended on the foundations that were also saying, how are we going to stay afloat? And so it was a time where there was a ton of scrambling, having to figure out the rescue fund and how to navigate getting some government aid, which I was able to do. And then we were able to pivot into providing kind of like a cost of living emergency funding. So I was able to fundraise with a couple of other small nonprofits. And we ended up giving out about $500,000 in aid funding to Bay Area musicians and theater artists that lost all their work. Wow. So that allowed me to both have a new purpose for the organization, so I could go to funders and say, look, here's what we're doing for the next however long. Here's why funding us is still vital. We're giving whatever you give us outside of the, the essentially general operating that's going to keep us afloat. It's all going out to the artists. So that's the way I was able to pivot for that organization. I do know the history of what happened at Stanford Jazz, because their revenue model and still is, based on bringing people in for an educational experience on campus for the jazz festival, for the music. And so when that all shut down, my predecessor here, who I know quite well, pivoted, and they went fully online. They canceled the jazz festival, but all the educational work And I think they served the same number of students that they would have in person in those first 2 years. So, and they were also able to get some pretty substantial aid funding. But for me, it was like just having to be a voice of like I was trying to help as many artists just on the mental side of it as well. Like just to they would call me and say like I don't know how I'm gonna pay my rent and what can I do and is should I? And so again, not that I knew the answer for every question that was being thrown to me, but that was basically how my days were spent, just talking to artist after artist who was trying to find some glimmer of hope in that. And
Yeah.
many of them, of course, couldn't sustain and had to leave the Bay Area and go live with family and all of that. So, looking back, I navigated, I think, the best as I could, considering that the Bay Area was so aggressive with the lockdown. We
Yeah.
were the first place to shut down, and so it was really shocking to be like told before anyone else, like, hey, you can't go in San Francisco anymore. Live, everything live is canceled. So it was surreal to say the least.
And they said that that virus were to spread like wildfire if the 49ers would have beat the Chiefs that year and they would have had the parade there. So
Right.
instead, we got the honor of being able to host that. But they said that would have been a huge epicenter because it Seattle on the coast, it was really
Yes.
hard. So,
I forgot that. That's right.
yeah, it's wild. So let's get into your roots before we get into this 54th annual extravaganza that's a 10-day event.
Yeah.
I want to begin with you. You had mentioned Wichita. Take me to the beginnings of your love of music and jazz and how you evolved to this point.
I'd love to. Yeah, so I am from a musical family. My father was the director of the percussion department at Wichita State University for the majority of his career. And he also played in the Wichita Symphony. He was a classical and jazz musician and fantastic teacher. And because he was an entrepreneur in terms of how he approached music education, he developed a well-deserved national and even international reputation for sort of being a maverick in this community. And as a result, he was attracting incredibly talented young musicians to study with him and to be part of the community. And so as a, starting in grade school, I started playing the bass. And I don't quite know why I picked that instrument. It was offered to me out of any one I could have done. But it was immediately I was surrounded by all his students who were, of course, super encouraging and into me wanting to play, the entire music department at the university. Like I was the university kid that was always hanging around the music hall. So it was a creative environment. And I got to start playing with people that were not only at a much higher level, but also much older at a young age. So, by the nature of being in a mid-size city, I started playing professional in that community by the time I was in early high school. And so, like, I would, and also because I played the bass, like, okay, I need a bass player for this polka band. Can you read polka music? I was like, okay, yeah. And I want this country band. And can you do this? And there was a Cuban band at the university and steel drum music and played jazz music with my dad. And so it was just a deep immersion at the time. And it was easy for me to fall in love with how everyone in our orbit loved music as much as I did and as much as my dad did. And so it just was kind of part of the literal air I breathed. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember the first live jazz show you saw that blew you away, that made you think that's something that you want more of?
Yeah, because I remember this distinctly, and I've told this story once before, that my love of music before the kind of what I just mentioned to you started really with rock and roll. I was a typical 80s rock kid, growing up with the music that everyone was growing up with. And when I thought of playing bass, it was because I wanted to play AC/DC or Iron Maiden. And I knew my dad's love of jazz music and of course had been around that, but it didn't speak to me at up to that. I didn't dislike it, but it wasn't what was giving me a heartbeat musically. But then my dad, I was maybe even going through a little bit of a rebellious period there, and my dad said, "Okay, I want you to come to this concert with me." I rolled my eyes and was a surly middle schooler and came along, didn't say much. But it was a university bassist, his name is Glenn Holmes, who taught at the department, and a guitar player who actually is if you know him, people know him as one of the best, and that's Jerry Hahn. And yeah, so I'm glad that name rings a bell for you. So he played a lot in Wichita. I know he played a lot in Kansas City. Pat Metheny lists him as someone he admired early on. So he was of that level and played with Jack DeJohnette. And so I saw this person playing guitar, and it was far and beyond even the shredders that I was loving. Like, okay, this is something different. He's got a mastery on the instrument that I haven't seen before. He can navigate the guitar fretboard like I hadn't really imagined. And the music was interactive in a way that I hadn't heard. And so I reluctantly, and I don't know why I was reluctant. I think it was just because I was still in that sort of transition to being a amenable teenager. I was reluctantly able to give my dad props to say, "Yeah, okay, that was cool. I liked it." But that's that, I yeah, that turned the corner for me, where I was like, there's something very deep in this music. Yeah.
So right before the pandemic happened, it was March 3rd, Bill Frisell came in with the trio, and he came to the Nelson Atkins Museum, and there was an
Yeah.
auditorium in there. And after the show, there was a Q&A, and he specifically pointed out Jerry and said, "This is the guy. Like, he is the one that has created so much tread in the world of jazz that people don't know about." But he
That's right.
specifically pointed him out for sure.
That's
So,
great. That's awesome. Yeah, exactly. Bill Frisell, it was a, yeah, just it's that's cool to hear. Yes.
For sure. So what kind of memories, before we get into the festival, what kind of memories do you have of Kansas City? Some foundational, seminal memories of the Kansas City area.
A midway point between Wichita and visiting my grandparents in a small farm community called Fairfax, Missouri. Upper northwest corner, I believe. So I loved going up there. But of course, I was really excited. Anytime we would do that, we would go to the plaza. We would eat at any number of restaurants that we all loved. Go shopping, and I would, we'd go during Christmas and enjoy the lights on the plaza. I don't know if you remember the Alameda
Oh,
Plaza.
yeah.
We'd often stay there. So I even, like, my brother and I have looked at old pictures of the Alameda Plaza and just the pool and the waterfall. And for me, I even remember how they stamped the ashtrays with their logos by the elevator doors. So for me, it was a really seminal memory of just that part of my childhood, that it was the best times of my life were going. And I mean, Wichita seemed exciting to me, but when I went to Kansas City, it just everything was a little more alive. The museum, I remember, just like as you just discussed, and so very, very fun. And then as I got older, I started to understand the history of the jazz scene and how that informed so much. And I remember being there in high school and seeing that someone I really admired, Terrence Blanchard, was playing there. And I was like, "Oh wow, so cool. He's coming just to play some dates in Kansas City." And so this is it was I just knew it of a place that attracted high level talent, that had a thriving jazz scene that was different than Wichita's, and that it was attracting touring artists. Wichita had its jazz festival, which my dad was a big part of. But Kansas City had kind of an continual scene that, of course, I didn't drive up all the time, but we were always aware of, and so yeah, it was a huge, huge piece of my childhood for sure.
And I think Terrence was on Altman's Kansas City soundtrack when he made that movie. I
That's
think
right.
he was a central figure on there. So let's get to the 54th annual festival. You got a lot going on. Miles at 100, Jimmy Heath at 100. There's all kinds of cats, Billy Childs, Branford Marsalis. So give me kind of an idea of how this extravaganza was cultivated and stitched together.
So the founder of Stanford Jazz Workshop, Jim Nadell, who is just recently retired, had this, what I think is really visionary idea that the workshop, which is our youth reaching arm, which is 4 weeks of summer camp, which we're just getting ready to start in July, is connected to the jazz festival. And so it's a combination of touring artists that we bring in, like Branford Marsalis, like Billy Childs, like Luciana Souza, who are coming in specifically for the festival. But we also have artists that perform at the jazz festival, say Anat Cohen and Taylor Eigsti, who then spend a week with us as educators. And so we get the best of both worlds. They do a show that reaches the jazz community here, but also the kids that get to spend the week from all over the world with us learning from all these people can say, oh, there's my combo director. I didn't know Anat was this. So they might not know these names as well as the jazz festival patrons do until they start spending time under their tutelage during the week. And so in that regard, we have a really kind of the luxury of looking at not only who are our A-list headliners that we just want to dream about bringing in, and if we can't afford five of those, who are some people that we can kind of try to target, and then who are the people that we want to target similarly of that level that can teach for a week, and can this person also teach for a week and do a festival show? And so there are so many chess pieces that come into play for us because of this combination that we don't just have to focus on a one and done, fly him in, fly him out, sort of deal.
So I'm curious, with Miles at 100 right now, it's everywhere, and we're talking about it, and we're thinking about the legacy that he left behind. All of these esteemed, acclaimed musicians that are coming in are on the forefront of modern jazz. They are the picture of the evolution of this art form. Do you think if Miles came back, he would be happy with where this art form has evolved to, with what's going on right now?
It would be. I'll preface by saying it might be presumptuous for me to speak on what Miles might think,
Right.
but I'm going to do it
Sure.
anyway.
Yeah.
And
For all of us, it is.
Miles is that he, and this is coming directly from that he of tradition, and that with that kind of a forward-looking and a vision to where the music is evolving. I know he didn't quite see the point in just rehashing. And so a lot of the artists that I see now seem to feel a lot of freedom in the established tradition and moving it beyond expectation. And that I've seen time and time again by people that we bring in might be performing in a more traditional segment of the jazz vocabulary. They're still making it personal, stretching it out. And if they're playing standards, it's in their own way. They're making really inventive arrangements. And so I would have to think that he would see some of these artists as taking that kind of freedom that he and others like Monk and Coltrane gave this music to say, okay, where else can it go? So I think everyone that we bring in really celebrates in individuality and innovation, which he, of course, was a champion of.
For sure. So let's give everybody a complete, more comprehensive overview. June 21st, July 31st, correct?
That's right. Yeah,
Okay.
exactly.
So if anybody wants to get involved, they want to get tickets, any of the good business, where's the best place to get a full list, all of the good information?
Yeah, stanfordjazz.org, stanfordjazz.org. And there's an easy way to find our schedule. Each show has a listing and a description. So if there are artists that you come across that you don't recognize immediately. There's great descriptions to say this is why this individual is exemplary and worthy of you to give a listen. So yeah, there's full information on the site that you could find on all the shows.
Okay, all right, excellent. I will put all those links in the show notes. So great to catch up with you, Corey. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much. Have a great time this summer. I really
Thanks,
appreciate your
Joe.
time, man.
Yeah, man, wonderful to check in with you, and thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thanks for listening and tuning into another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in Stanford, Wichita, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Corey for swinging on by the show. If you want to hear more Neon Jazz interviews, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us at YouTube, and for everything Neon Jazz, go to theneonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.